This is your invitation to leap ahead in your engineering career. The inaugural Product Development Expo, PDX, happening in Phoenix, Arizona on Tuesday, May 14th, 2024, brings you face-to-face with the engineering elite. These aren't just any speakers, they're the industry's highest performing product development engineers, ready to share the methods and strategies that have defined their success. Imagine learning design for manufacturability from those who've redefined it, diving deep into tolerance analysis with pioneers, exploring novel engineering applications for Excel, and unlocking unique 3D printing strategies all in one place. These high-caliber engineers will open their playbooks, offering practical, hands-on lessons forged over decades in the trenches of innovation. Don't miss out on this unparalleled opportunity to absorb the wisdom of those who've led the charge in engineering breakthroughs. PDX is your chance to not just meet but learn directly from these legends of engineering. Mark the date, May 14th, 2024, in Phoenix. Elevate your skills, ignite your creativity, and join a community of growth-minded engineering professionals at PDX. Learn more at teampipeline.us/PDX. Hello and welcome to the Being an Engineer podcast. Today we are thrilled to welcome Shobhana Radhakrishnan, a distinguished figure in the engineering world with a remarkable journey through the tech landscape. As the Senior Director of Engineering at Google TV, Shobhana has left her mark on industry giants like Roku, Netflix, Yahoo, and Symantec, showcasing her prowess in engineering leadership and her dedication to building innovative technology solutions. Her commitment to STEM diversity and empowering future women leaders in engineering is both inspiring and transformative. Shobhana's story is a testament to the power of perseverance, innovation, and the importance of fostering diverse teams and achieving groundbreaking results. Join us as we delve into her insights and experiences, offering valuable lessons for engineers at all stages of their careers. Shobhana, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you, Aaron, for the warm welcome. Really, really excited to be here.
Okay. Can you share maybe, was there like a pivotal moment in your career that helped shape your path towards engineering leadership?
That's a great question. You know, I would say in my case, some of it is just organic evolution. And then there were a couple of pivotal moments. So maybe I can mention a couple of moments that come to mind as I'm reflecting on your question. One is just, you know, during my experience at Yahoo, which was my second job out of grad school, I had an opportunity to be what was called TL, which is technical lead. So you don't move into the management kind of leadership role yet, but you have an opportunity to lead a longer term planning and mentoring other engineers, just kind of testing the waters on engineering leadership role while you're still actively writing code and implementing code, the thing you've been familiar with for a few years. And my then manager at Yahoo, who was one of the most amazing mentors I've had, he said, why don't you try this role? And I had an opportunity to just lead two other engineers working on next generation of the system I had helped architect from scratch. And so it was a very comfortable transition. And these two engineers were great talent, high energy. Both were actually fresh grads. And so I learned from them as much as they learned from me, I think. And I really enjoyed just hanging out with them and helping them be successful. And so that was one pivotal moment where I internalized and experienced what engineering leadership in early stages was like. And I said, yeah, I think this is the path I want to take. And then as I eventually grew, I had opportunities in Symantec and later at Netflix and Roku to lead company-wide initiatives. For example, at Netflix, for the House of Cards, which was the first original from Netflix launched in 2013, I was given the opportunity to be the overall engineering lead. And this is across the company, which means a lot of unknowns to navigate. Imagine the first original production. So you're sort of balancing the creative movie maker requirements into engineering plans. And so it definitely stretched me way outside my comfort zone. And I had a chance to partner with pretty much every engineering leader across the company. And I also had, again, another supportive manager myself there, which helped. And it took well over a year or close to 2 years from inception to getting it all the way to launch. And it was a really magical moment. And I can think of that as another pivotal moment for me to feel like, oh, it's definitely a good path I've taken. And this is something, you know, that experience of being outside your comfort zone, learning, but then also bringing something that you have been doing for a while and helping the overall effort. It's just such a magical combination. So those two come to mind. And then more recently at Google TV, I've had a chance to interact with Google research, search organizations to bring the magic of Google core recommendations engines to content personalization, which is yet another outside the comfort zone, but immensely satisfying launch experience in leadership. So these are the moments that come to mind.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing those. It's really interesting hearing you talk about the creative side of things and how you had to interface with that coming from a technical background. I know that what we do, the engineering world that I'm familiar with, which is not software, it's hardware, mechanical mostly, we don't get to touch the creative side almost at all. You know, some engineers, depending where they work, they have industrial designers that are, you know, kind of making things look nice, right? They're sculpting these devices and products. And so that's kind of like the creative aspect. But your world is so different than that because you're dealing with entertainment, right? So there's the creative directors and the producers and the, I don't know if you interface with the talent at all, but there's this whole other world that a lot of the engineers that I work with, just we never even see or touch. I'm curious, were there compromises that you had to make from a technical standpoint because or to facilitate or support the creative side of things?
You know, it's very interesting because I've spent over a decade now in media and entertainment across Netflix, Roku, and now Google TV, and this is the world I live in. I've been living in. In the role at Netflix, while there was more direct interaction with the creative side of things, putting requirements into our systems, in my current role, we work more closely with content partners, content providers like, you know, Netflix, Amazon Prime, YouTube, and several thousands and thousands of providers, or content apps is the other term that's used for that. And they work directly with the content creators, whether they're user-generated content or producers. Having said that, to your question about how do you cater architecture and engineering process to support the creative side, the evolution, which is very different on the creative side, I think a couple of things. One is it's important to iterate easily and quickly. It's much easier to say than do it, as any person who's built even software. I mean, it's much easier to iterate in software than hardware, as I'm sure you know. But even iterating on software comes with risk because we build a platform that includes the operating system that's close to the hardware layer. It involves server-side algorithms, machine learning model changes, and the UI or the user visible layers. And some layers are easy to iterate and accommodate new requirements late in the game than others. And also the other angle is there's a wide variation of the kinds of systems that each of these content providers have. For example, live TV providers have a completely different infrastructure, completely different, like live news feed has very different data, very different integrations than your premium content, regular SVOD, what we call SVOD, which is video on demand or streaming content. And so it's important to build the architecture in a way that you can easily abstract the layers that are different for each of these creative entities. But abstract are the ones that are common so that when you make changes, it's easy to adapt, but you're not building custom solutions for each one. So that's very important from an architectural vision perspective. And the complement of that is the engineering execution process itself, which is how do you front load the things that may not change that often, but can cause high risk with change. And usually these are the layers that are closer to the hardware. But then how do you enable easy iteration, experiment and fail and learn in the layers that are more visible to the user so that the user's voice is part of how you evolve a feature. So you need to evolve very different processes, almost like for different layers of the architecture, but make it all work together so it's not chaotic for the organization.
Yeah, I'm thinking about when I pop open Netflix on the TV and it shows me all these suggestions, right? We think you'd like this or we think you'd like that. And there are even scores there, right? 97% chance that you're going to like this. Can you talk a little bit about the engineering behind how those recommendations and even those discrete like numerical values scores are provided?
And that's an important angle for any system that's trying to develop personalized recommendations. And each of the providers like Netflix, YouTube, and others may have their own algorithms, which I may not be in the best position to directly comment on. But from a Google TV platform perspective, so Google TV is a platform that sits outside individual apps, but is able to bring content from all these apps to your top page. And we leverage So the way we do things is at very high level, a few dimensions. One is we try to get an idea from the users, both explicit and implicit signals, on what they tend to prefer, what they tend to watch, but at the same time, not clustering the same kind of content and jamming it in front of them. So there is some what I'll call randomization. So they discover new content, so it remains interesting to them. So we let the users indicate a lot to us on what they prefer and what they'd rather not have. So we, for example, have thumbs up, thumbs down, as a way to get that feedback. That's a small example. And then we also lean on content providers like Netflix and others who may have their own scores. And then we are able to bring that up and surface it. For example, if you turn a TV with Google TV on, you'll see those scores and which provider, you may see ratings, which are a little different than the match score. It's like rating on, for example, IMDb or other entities. We try to provide as much information as possible so the users have the right information to decide whether to click on it or not. In addition to that, we also provide price because we support even things like transactional award, or we try to bring content from apps that they've not yet subscribed to, but they may be interested in getting to know about. So we try to bring the right amount of pricing information so the users get the best out of their platform. And the interesting challenge is we need to do all this while keeping the UI simple and not cluttered. So it's appealing and useful and not in their face. So that's the fun of our challenge.
Yeah. How do you strike that balance between having enough information, but not overwhelming someone with too much detail? Are there like user groups that you approach and do testing and then take that feedback and iterate it? Or is it largely, we think this is going to work, let's test it. And then you kind of track how users use it and adjust as needed, or maybe all of the above?
Actually, I am going to say an all of the above answer. at Google, we obsess over what users think and want. For example, there are what we call UXR or user experience research groups which have a fairly structured approach and are on an ongoing basis throughout the year, throughout the month, engaging with current and potential users. That is one of the big data points that help us even design features, and especially designing the user experience part of the features. We also actively let users give explicit feedback, and we also look at implicit feedback. For example, if I've scrolled past 5 spots and then I've clicked on the 6th one, the click on the 6th one is just as important as me skipping the first 5. So we care about that. We give a lot of importance to what the users are already entitled to because they would prefer to watch content from what they're already subscribing to. So we use these. This is what I mean by implicit and explicit signals from the user. And then the third part is what you're talking about, which is, once we have the feature in front of the users, looking at it in a data-driven approach on how do they react to it. And there are two forms this can take. One is, we may roll out an experiment to a partial set of users, look at how they react, and we may actually be able to iterate on the feature before rolling it out to the broader audience. The other is post-launch, we continue to look at how people are engaging, how much people are engaging and how, and then iterating it on an ongoing basis. So we do both of those as well.
You mentioned getting feedback from users. Do users typically know what they want? I have found this to be a problem, even with myself. When someone asks me for feedback, maybe I'll give them feedback and then they implement that feedback and I realize, oh, that's actually not what I wanted. Is that a big problem that you've had to deal with? Or do you find that for the most part, when you get a sufficient quantity of data from users, it's pretty accurate?
I think this is why we need to lean on both ends. One is the explicit, what are the users telling us when we ask them questions? And then as we provide what we think are the solutions to address their needs, how are they actually reacting to it?
Yeah,
okay. So it's both together. I agree with you, because it's first when we're asked any survey questions, it's a little bit of opinion and all of that, right? And then it's what do they actually do with it? How do they actually engage? What is actually appealing to them? Being able to see that. Again, with a lot of consideration for privacy and security, we're very, very careful about that as well. But we try to take both of those because we have found that just one or the other doesn't do justice overall.
Got it. That makes total sense. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your leadership role. What you've worked in very large companies, and I'm sure have led very large teams where probably high pressure environments, right? You're trying to meet aggressive deadlines and you're pushing the bounds of technology. How do you foster a culture in an environment like that where people feel comfortable speaking up and asking questions, maybe asking for help, maybe expressing doubts or concerns? What are some strategies that you have found to be successful?
I think that what you're asking about is a very critical part of any team culture to get the best products out, to get the best teams operating well with each other. A couple of things. One is just having a culture of what I'll call blameless retrospective, which is, let's say you've just had a major launch after working on it for a year or two. Having the whole team involved, not just people with certain titles or like say senior enough people, just like everyone who worked on it, be able to contribute to say, that was great. So what things went well and what are things we would like to improve the next time? And depending on the size of the team, I've had teams where we used to just sit around in a big hall. Maybe it's like 20 or 30 people. We just have a facilitator who captures notes on a whiteboard and we make sure it's actionable. Or there are initiatives where it's hundreds of people and then it's have a doc, let everyone contribute to it and then like read out the extracted summary and see if that resonates. So this can take all of these forms, but having that sort of blameless retrospective is just a standing, just normalizing it. So it's not a personal thing, but we are able to talk about where did we mess up. That's one important part. So it's just habit and it's normalized. I think that's the important part. The second is the leader themselves being vulnerable and being honest when we messed up, because we do. And so, you know, sometimes, again, these may be very difficult because maybe we hurt the business with a call we made. And it's very hard to come out and say, for small mistakes, it's easier to do it than larger ones. But regardless of this, if people feel like the leader will take responsibility for what they did, I feel like that can help, again, normalize it. I think that's the key, is normalizing what I call quote-unquote failure, because it's just a way to keep charging forward. I don't think there's any team or any engineer who has never had a bug or a bad decision made in their life.
We've done a lot of work with one company in particular over the years, and the engineering leader there, I've always really appreciated, because what we do is custom at Pipeline, our team. Everything is 100% custom. So we're inventing things with pretty much every project, right? And when you invent something, there is inherent risk that it's not going to work, or at least that it's not going to work the first time. And this engineering leader at our customer, whenever we're in a design review with our team and their team together, and we're talking about, well, what if we implement it this way? And how about taking this direction, right? And maybe there's something that we don't know for sure if it's going to work, but collectively, we think it probably will. He will always say something to the effect of, and he'll be speaking to his team, not to our team, which I really appreciate. And he'll say something like, okay, now team, remember, we are all making this decision together. We're agreeing with Pipeline that we think this is going to work, but we don't know for sure. So if they go out and build this and it doesn't work, it's not just on Pipeline. This is on all of us together. So it's kind of the blameless approach that you're referring to, right? Whether it makes it safe for us to try something and fail, right? Because we know that we're not going to be crucified if it doesn't work, because he's already set that expectation.
Yes, exactly. And something we used to do in one of my teams before is we used to have the sentence repeated often, which is, it's okay to make mistakes, but it's not okay not to learn from mistakes.
I love that.
Very simple. It resonates for everybody, respect of the level or responsibility they have. So,
okay, so I'm going to ask you a question. And if you're comfortable speaking about this, being a little bit vulnerable, maybe, what is the biggest mistake that you've made at the different companies that you've worked at, let's just say in your career, and what did you learn from it?
How long do we have?
Love it. Great response.
Let me pick maybe two. One is more of a, you know, like a technical kind of mistake. The other is more a career mistake. The first one, actually, this was when I was, you know, just first time learning how to deploy a major system. This was very early stages of my career. I actually made a change directly in production, in the, you know, production system, because, you know, we had tested for a few months and all of that. So we knew the software was very well tested, but then there was a configuration change that I had to make up, like time pressure. And I said, you know, what can go wrong? I'll make it directly in production and merge it back. You're laughing because you know exactly how such decisions start off most of the time.
Yeah.
And I actually brought the service down.
Oh, no.
And it was immediately noticed because it brought some high-profile websites down. And the good news is this could be fixed in just the few minutes in which I could bring it down. So I quickly fixed it and then learned never to do that again.
Thank goodness.
So that is one mistake I made as an engineer, and I have not done it since, I'm glad to say. And the second is, and by the way, this was my first experience with blameless postmortem, because my manager had to stand right next to me because someone in management two levels above him also noticed it just as quickly as I did. But he just helped me get through that testing, just kind of supporting, but then helping me learn as a mentor. So I wanted to make that point as well here. And you know, the second one is more of just career choice that you make. And I have learned since this to say, you know, the people you're going to work with and the actual project you're going to work with are the most important things to me. This made me get in touch with what motivated me, actually, this learning experience. So there was an example where I took on a role because I liked the technology that I was going to work on, and my commute was less than half. So there were practical factors. But there was something in my heart that made me feel like the culture of the team may not be a great fit. I'm not saying that it's a bad culture. It's more of what's a good fit for you versus not. And I still went ahead and made the decision. And I thought, oh, it's going to be shorter commute, and I like the technology, I'm going to learn it. And then, you know, it just felt like, oh, this culture just feels like this, X, and what I enjoy is Y. And, you know, I still was able to, thankfully, influence a lot of changes in the culture and so on. But then eventually I felt like maybe I can work on something else, then it might be more fun. So I learned a lot, and I did enjoy the technology. I enjoyed a lot of people I worked with, were working with them. But this was a learning for me to say, don't optimize for practical things like, you know, commute, comp, title. Like, those things are important, but be in touch with what your personal motivators are and gravitate towards whatever makes that shine. And so that was the other mistake I made and learned from.
Very wise words. Wonderful. Well, let me take a very short break here and share that our company, Pipeline Design and Engineering, develops new and innovative manufacturing processes for complex products, then implements them into manual fixtures or fully automated machines to dramatically reduce production costs and improve production yields for OEMs. Today, we are speaking with Shobhana Radhakrishnan, and let's talk a little bit about diversity in the workplace. This is a topic of which you have been a proponent. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you first become interested in this, and what are some strategies that you found to be effective in promoting diversity, especially within kind of the STEM environment?
Sure. I think, again, this is another critical fabric in any team to get a team feeling their best. I think for me at core, that's what motivated me into that. A couple of specific things is, again, back to the example that I was talking about on what realizing what my motivators were and what energized me the most and really learning about it. That made me reflect on how do you best energize everybody, because each person's motivators are actually different. And then I started paying more attention as a manager and leader to that element. And then you start noticing actually the diversity in the team, that each person comes with different motivators, different aspirations, and probably different factors that may be holding them back intentionally or unintentionally. And then I started leaning into more of the diversity elements that everyone's familiar with, you know, gender diversity, racial diversity. But what I've learned over time, thanks to a lot of training I've had a chance to have and discussion forums I've had a chance to be part of, is there's a lot more kinds of diversity than just visually obvious. For example, introverted versus extroverted personalities. That is a big diversity on the team, you know, beyond the gender, race, sexual orientation, which are all important elements too, or even the zip code where someone grew up actually shapes very different mindset, very different constraints. And so really educating yourself on the different kinds of diversity and how everyone can be able to work on the thing they love. So I think that was an important internalization for me as I started paying more attention based on my own experience. The other was I had a chance several years ago to volunteer at my children's high school in the robotics club. And I noticed that in the freshman year, it started with like a reasonable mix of girls and boys, still not 50-50, but a reasonable mix. And I noticed in this case, this is anecdotal, I don't want to generalize, but I saw the girls dropping out in the sophomore year, only because they didn't have more friends to hang out, which in this case were just other girls. This friend group used happened to be other girls. And I was surprised because I absolutely loved robotics and engineering from when I was 12. And I was like, what is there not to be leaned into this field? It's just so much fun to build. Because my parents had been supportive. I had never reflected on what gender identity I had when I chose to do engineering or pursue the career. So this made me reflect on why did they not feel included, because they didn't have friends of the similar gender. And then I felt like if they loved what they did and we just enabled them to keep doing what they loved, they clearly loved building those robots and testing them, then maybe they'd have stayed longer rather than seeing, do I belong from a different identity kind of entity, just connect based on the passion and continue to do what I love and make them feel like they could just do what they love irrespective of who else they were collaborating with. So this was another data point that made me reflect again a little deeper. So I ended up running a not-for-profit to foster diversity in STEM in high schools for a few years, working like organizing hackathons and bringing in people with more diverse backgrounds to participate, which I found immensely enriching and energizing. And then as I applied this back to the workplace, this was also something that I felt like we could even take a more formalized, more structural approach by having, for example, I've had a chance to have all of my leads or all of my team take on some training on both being aware of privileges, being aware of different kinds of diversity beyond the obvious ones, and also how to be an ally in the room. You don't have to be in the majority group or have a certain title to be an ally and empower others. How just because you're in the meeting, you have a voice to empower others. And so having undergone these kinds of trainings and also being able to enable my teams to be part of this as a proactive role has been very, very, I think, has brought really good results in terms of the teams, everyone on the team feeling like they're included, they have a voice, and they can do what they love.
Terrific. I love that you kind of reframed diversity is not just gender and ethnicity, et cetera, but there are like subtexts, right, of diversity. What zip code did you grow up in? Introvert versus extrovert. Those, I think, maybe get overlooked in the conversation about diversity. And I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit. If you can't think of a story, that's completely fine. But if you can, that would be really interesting to hear about if there was a story or experience where having diversity in your team led to a specific solution that you think would not have surfaced without that diversity?
Absolutely. This may be one more question where it's like, how much time do we have? But I'll pick one. I'll pick one example. This can be a tactical and anecdotal example, but I think it could resonate for people in large or small companies. And this could go back to introverted and extroverted, or this could simply be someone is too shy to engage, which doesn't map to extrovert or introvert necessarily. It's just in some design meetings, I noticed that there were, let's assume that there's about 10 people in the design review. There are a couple of people who had a lot of good thoughts, but they would mostly bring it up in one-on-ones before or after the meeting, but not speak up at the meeting. And I wanted to see if they could feel like they had a voice in the meeting, because you know how organically in meetings, the person who goes to the whiteboard and, you know, who's out there may sometimes take over the meeting. This is not good or bad. It's just natural evolution if you just leave it to organic, purely organic evolution. So one thing I decided to try was to say, we will have a design document draft sent ahead of the meeting, X days ahead of the meeting, and everybody add offline comments before the meeting. And we'll discuss those comments in the meeting as one of the first things. And I noticed that this enabled everyone who was more comfortable bringing up comments offline in a one-on-one smaller forum. They were all like actively chiming in the doc. And then it forced that topic to be brought up and discussed. And therefore, they started getting comfortable talking because their point is getting discussed. So they started leaning into the meeting, and then it just became second nature.
Yeah. Now they have a voice. That's a great idea. Love it. I guess continuing that thread of diversity, what can companies or teams do to better support women in engineering? You mentioned the robotics team that you were involved with, the girls would tend to drop out, largely maybe not because they didn't enjoy the technical aspect of this club, but because they didn't have other friends that were girls who were going there. Is there a parallel there in professional work? Or if not, what are some other suggestions that you have to facilitate women working in technology?
Absolutely. I think maybe twofold. One is everyone likes to see people they can relate to on the team. That's just all of us as human beings. That's just how we are. Now, one thing is just walking the talk of like when they come for even interviews or they just want to know more about the team. Just making sure that they can see everyone has a voice in the team, irrespective of how they look or where they are from. Because the team culture will show. The moment you are in interviews with the team, I think it's very easy to tell what the team culture is of the interviewers. And so letting it show through your questions, through your answers. And so within the team, just walking the talk. So it'll come across to prospective women employees as well as current women employees. That's one. The second is showcasing the women on the team more. For example, in one of our teams, we made sure that the interview panel always had at least one woman. And we noticed that women are more likely to ask questions or accept our offers once we made that change. Now, I can't say it's purely cause-effect. There could be some correlation because we didn't scientifically analyze through surveys or anything for the candidates. But just little things like that, or when you're organizing a meetup or when your team is going for a conference, make sure that the women from the team are visible. So anyone who's, a prospective or current employee can see the women in action. And that just helps all women feel like they belong. The other is also, this could apply to women as well as any other, what I would refer to as minority group for the demographic that you have on the team. Just having proactive outreach, like making sure they have mentors, making sure they have forums where they can connect with each other. And this can be as simple as a coffee meet and greet that the organization holds. So just thinking about proactive ways of engaging and growing the women so that they, again, feel like they belong, they have ways to ask questions, they have people they can connect with, that they are comfortable with. These go a long way.
Great suggestions. Can you think of a time where you were able to dramatically accelerate the speed with which your team moved by implementing a particular strategy or a tool or a forum or something? I I have this personal mission to accelerate the speed of engineering. And I'm always asking other engineers what they have done, you know, what has been successful in your career?
This is one of those where I will say I have tried a few things and they have worked. And I feel like this is a constant learning journey. You can always make things better. That's how I view this topic in general. I think a few things. One is that when we say, how can I make engineering go faster? It's kind of tempting to say, how can you code faster, you know, for software?
Yeah, right. Which is not a solution, right?
Which is not a solution.
The answer is, yeah, it's not work more hours or just do it faster.
That's right. That or work more weekends right. or,
yeah,
you know, yeah, and yeah. with hardware, you know, it's even harder to position it like that. Can you manufacture more chips faster? No, you can't.
Yeah, right.
right. I think it's more internalizing what are all the things that affect the productivity of software engineers. For example, timely decision making or closing on requirements easily, or it can be the tools, like how quickly is somebody able to ramp up and write their first line of code on your team. That tells you something about whether the tools and documentation are where they need to be for productivity. So first, recognizing it's a multi-pronged approach and it doesn't happen overnight. I know this may not be the silver bullet answer, but this is the reality is we want to accelerate engineering. First of all, reflecting on that. And listening and observing, listening to the teams and observing data on what's actually driving productivity opportunities for your org. Because each org and company have different factors that influence it. Really taking even a couple of weeks, like take that time to really grok it and reason about it. And then sharing your observations. I think that's important for a leader. Because it's important for the team to come along with you no matter what change you want to influence. So it has that added value. Plus, it avoids blind spots for the leader. So that's step number one. And the second is, I think, just a lightweight way for everyone to unblock each other is critical. And by that, I mean, if a software engineer needs some code reviewed by a TL or a design approach signed off by a TL, then what is the quickest way that can be done so this person can move to coding? Or it can simply be a product manager is looking for, can you tell me if you can do this in 3 months or 3 years so I can tell this customer so I can close on the deal? That itself is an accelerator for the org. And we, like software engineers, need to unblock the product manager in that case. And how do you make this the most lightweight way possible? So it's not about having, let's have weekly meetings for 5 hours to get through this. So one thing, a few things we have tried this, we have tried in multiple teams is just sometimes having a daily sync, which is 10 or 15 minutes, but cross-functional, not just engineering, not just one team, everybody working on it, come together 15 minutes. And there is a very like, tell me what's happened, tell me what you're blocked on, who can unblock you, and within the day, just unblock or a path to unblock. So those kinds of mechanisms. Along with, of course, big picture review, like many initiatives we work on are all multi-year, multi-quarter. So just the daily sync and lightweight doesn't solve all the needs in terms of tracking and being able to manage risks. So complementing this lightweight unblocking with the big picture viewing and risk management and expectation setting seems to work in most cases. Now, the prescriptive elements of the logistics of how exactly you do it depends on the team. For example, I've been in a startup where the daily stand-up used to be everybody standing up in their bullpen, talking and sitting back down. But in a larger company with multiple buildings, it's a little different. So I think the detailed logistics depend on the teams and company size and culture and external versus internal entities. But having that combination seems to have a magical effect on accelerating the pace, because I really feel accelerating the pace of software productivity or engineering productivity is about accelerating the pace of information flow. In all directions. So you can keep unblocking, managing risks in a quick, lightweight way.
Yeah. I know that we've, when we have projects with very aggressive schedules where out of necessity, we do have to move faster somehow, we have implemented daily team huddles. We already have, we're a small company, you know, there are 15, 20 people, and we have daily huddles as a team, but as a company. But when we have specific projects, and maybe there are four or five people working on a specific project, and there's a very aggressive deadline, we'll start having daily huddles just for that project team as well. And the daily communication that unlocks has been so valuable in terms of finding out that someone was blocked, but the team leader didn't know about it. But now we're having these daily conversations. Oh, okay, I can figure out a solution there. Speaking of communication, this is a huge topic. And oftentimes when I ask engineering leaders or seasoned senior level engineers, what is one of the most valuable skills for an engineer to have, they will say good communication skills, effective communication. Can you think of any examples or stories where poor communication in one of your teams led to something bad happening, right? Missing a schedule or producing the wrong product or something like that. And then conversely, have there been any specific tactics that you have found or developed or refined over the years for effectively communicating something to, you know, whether it's to your team or between team members or you to your stakeholders, but just some golden nugget of wisdom for how to be more effective as a communicator in some specific area? Because obviously this is a huge, huge topic and we could fill months of podcasts just with that alone. So feel free to dive in and get very specific on where you take that answer.
Absolutely. I think communication is critical for engineers, like your other guest has said. I think communication from engineers / engineering can be a few different levels. One is my design clear to the people who need to review? That's like a basic level at which it starts. And the other is also communicating for proactive risk mitigation. For example, engineers hesitate a lot to say, I have a risk of slipping because I depend on this other team and they haven't delivered. I've noticed that engineers are always nervous about saying they're going to slip or they're likely to slip. They want to say that they can make it happen. So they're just troopers trying to work long hours and they don't want to, quote unquote, escalate about some other team. And that's a common sensitivity because especially in early stages of your career, which actually affects projects at a big picture level. And so bringing bad news early and effectively, like by quote unquote bad news, I mean, there is a risk and you bring it up and you could still mitigate it. So bubbling it up in a way that is actionable for your senior leadership, whoever you think needs to take action, but in a timely fashion. So at certain levels of leadership, it could be I have to write a long paragraph explaining the technical complexity. Or the more you up level, it's like this is the one sentence and this is the one action I need this leader to take and I need that to happen now. How do I convey it? So I feel like along with, you know, up leveling your technical details to non-technical audience, which every engineer needs to do because you want to work with product management, UX designers, UX researchers, and you need to be able to convey what you're trying to say to the non-technical audience. That's very important muscle to develop. I think one example on the second part, which I was talking about, which is maybe I need to escalate to get some help, but I'm hesitating and I just feel like, oh, I can make the schedule work. I keep going and then it's too late. That has happened, luckily, for intermediate milestones in my teams. Multiple times, like different small projects have happened. And these have usually been intermediate milestones because there is usually some program management or someone senior overseeing the bigger picture execution. So it's usually caught before that. But it did cause some moving to yellow status before it came back to green for a few months because something wasn't brought up early. And then as we dug into it, it was mainly due to just hesitation to quote unquote escalate. So we basically then had a discussion to say, you know, bringing something up to a senior leader in the team for help is not escalation. You're not kind of telling on the other team or anything. It's just information flow. Bring it up. You need somebody to take action. And you're just driving your leader to take an AI for you, take an action item for you. So think about it like that. Just like they can give you action items, you can give them action items too. And so this did have this impact where it moved into yellow status and had to green after it was mitigated, but it could have stayed in green months ahead of going to yellow. So that's one example. That's one example that comes to mind. And I think there are several positive examples also, which is, sometimes I see leaders can listen to, like just read between the lines and say, I can see you're saying it's like a mild risk, but let me double click here. And then, you kind of ask questions enough that they say, yeah, actually, it is a risk to the project. So how do you help your leaders develop that muscle? So then the engineers start becoming comfortable having that conversation. It's something, because we talked about this topic all the leads in the group are leaning in to encourage teams to feel more comfortable bringing things up early, no matter what their level is. So I think that's a positive side effect of the learning story from the learning.
Terrific. We have our engineering manager here likes to say that bad news doesn't age well. And I always thought that was a clever saying. Yeah, very true. Very true. Okay. Well, Shobhana, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing so much about your experience and insights into engineering and engineering leadership. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you think would be informative or useful for the listeners to hear?
I think we covered a lot of topics. It was really exciting to talk about all these topics with you, Aaron. I think, just a couple of thoughts for something that resonated with me throughout my career, in case it resonates with your listeners. It is, follow your passion. If you love building something, just go for it. Don't take no for an answer or let any door close. Just knock on doors and follow your passion is what I like to tell everyone.
Excellent advice. Great. Thank you so much. All right. Well, thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you, Aaron. It was great being here.
I'm Aaron Moncur, founder of Pipeline Design and Engineering. If you liked what you heard today, please share the episode. To learn how your team can leverage our team's expertise developing turnkey equipment, custom fixtures, and automated machines, and with product design, visit us at teampipeline.us. Thanks for listening.